We're going to hear House Bill 2050, which is a bill that I have introduced first. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2050. I'm not going to testify on this behalf because you know I can talk forever. That's a bad idea. So what we're going to do is we're going to bring Dave Nelson and whomever else that he would like to bring forward with him to testify on this bill. Ray is going to share with us a few thoughts about basically what this bill is and what it does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2050 requires the State Department of Agriculture to adopt rules governing the selling and the selling and purchasing of grass seed crops. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have in your packet the dash two amendment. There is an amended dash two amendment sitting before you that adds clover and purchase. I'm prepared, Mr. Chair, to go over the dash two amendments as they were received prior to this meeting. If you would like then to go over the proposed.
Okay, why don't we hear from our panel of witnesses first before we get deeply into the amendments because they substantially alter the bill. So let's go forward in that direction. Welcome, gentlemen. For the record, state your name. Dave.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Nelson. I represent the Oregon Seed Council. And we're here before you to support the newly improved Dash 2 amendments, which are essentially a gut and stuff of the chair's bill with his permission. Chair Krupp, if you recall back to our discussions and all of the discussions about the ABT situation and some of the problems that that situation precipitated within the industry, and the chair discussed at that time looking at a number of issues, and one of those being improving or putting some sideboards around the payment process from seed companies to seed growers. As they do business here in the state of Oregon. And the chair asked that, even going back as far as last September, that we began working on some issues within the seed industry and trying to tighten up the process of the contractual relationship between seed companies and seed growers. And that process began with a series of meetings in the fall involved the Oregon Seed Trade Association, which is the association of seed companies here in the state. And our chairman of the Seed Council's Legislative Committee is Mr. Dave Dorfler on the far right, and he chaired those meetings, and I'd like to ask him, he's also a seed grower from the Silverton Hills, and with me is Mr. Klaus Sass, who's the president and general manager of DLF Jenks Seed Company in Tangent and the chairman of the Oregon Seed Trade Association's Legislative Committee. So, Dave, you want to talk about a little bit about the process, then we'll go through the particulars.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm Dave Dorfler, grower in Hill. This began essentially with calls to ODA on concerns of late payment. And so a meeting was started there. Then I came into the process, and we had meetings with the growers and Representative Krupp. And after that, we had meetings with Farm Bureau seed dealers and worked this through about a six-month period with OSTA. And at this point, we feel we have an excellent bill, and I think this is very necessary for the industry. Thank you.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what the bill does, if you tick down through it, is to put a series of processes in place through the Oregon Department of Agriculture that bring requirements to bear on payment for grass seed delivered to a seed to a wholesale seed dealer. And the reason we went through the Department of Agriculture is that's where wholesale seed dealers are licensed and regulated under the Commodity Inspection Division. So what we tried to do is to develop a process that left the maximum amount of contractual negotiation between seed companies and seed dealers within the sideboards created by the amendments before you. Section 1 is a series of definitions that have not existed in the seed industry. Definition number 1 is the final payment date for seed purchase under a feed production contract. Subsection 2 describes the delivery date, which is a notice given by a seed company to a seed grower for delivering seed to be sold under the terms of the contract. Seed production contract, and as you see on our handwritten amendment to that, we've added on line 8 that this bill will also cover clover seed growers, and we have a clover seed grower here who will testify shortly, as well as on line 11. Line 13, we added, we had overlooked contracts of purchase of seed that are grown on a public open market variety where a seed company would enter into an agreement to purchase seed that they had not contracted with a seed grower to produce of their variety. So we've added the purchase contracts as well as the production contracts. So those definitions then take you to Section 2, where by a seed production contract or a purchase contract must include a requirement for the wholesale seed dealer to make payment to the seed grower within the, or at the end of a 30-day period following that production contract or purchase of that seed, unless then the seed company and the seed grower negotiate different payment terms. But that then gives the seed grower a position of strength to bargain or to negotiate the terms of that contract with the seed company. Now the seed grower can simply say, well, in the absence of agreement on different terms, it reverts back to the 30-day period. If the seed company then, on page 2, the way this works is if the seed company does not pay as, in accordance with the terms of the contract, then the seed grower can notify the State Department of Agriculture, who will do two things. One, they will call the seed company and say, what's the problem? They can then give the seed company notice of 30 days, that they have 30 days to correct the problem and impose an interest charge during that delinquent period of time of 1% per month. At the end of that period of time, if the seed company has not met its financial responsibility, the final hammer is that the Department of Agriculture can suspend the wholesale seed dealer's license, which would do a couple of things. It would bring pressure to bear to pay. Secondly, it would prevent the seed company from getting in further if they were, in fact, financially out of control. Then at the subsection or section 5 then restates the provisions of the Plant Variety Protection Act, which then upon 30 days notice by a seed grower to the seed company, the seed grower gives notice that they will sell or can sell the seed by the variety name to another seed company. So it gives them an out if they're being if the seed's not being taken. So you've got a process and a final drop-dead date at the end of it. I think that we've negotiated this out fairly thoroughly with the Seed Trade Association, with members of the and presidents of seed companies, and they feel that it's a responsible approach that does allow and maintain flexibility within the industry, within their business, and at the same time puts some sideboards around and requires financial responsibility.
Klaus, your thoughts?
I'm Klaus Sass, legislative chairman for the OSTA, and my thoughts are that as Dave and Dave have said here, that this has gone through quite a process to get where it's at, and from the Seed Trade Association, there haven't been many statements of opposition. So it would appear to me that that people have done a good job on this, and there is a comfort level. There's always some nervousness, but there seems to be a comfort level.
Okay. Thank you. Members, do we have questions in regards to this issue?
Mr. Chair, certainly.
Yes, we will. Okay. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chair would like to call Eric Bowers.
Eric, if you'd come forward. And on deck will be Doug Fast. Doug, are you here? You are? Why don't you come on up, both?
Let's do that.
Welcome to you both. Good to see you. And for the record, state your name.
I'm Eric Bowers, fourth generation seed grower from Harrisburg. Known Jeff for a while.
Yeah, a few years, Eric.
Do you guys know what a farmer calls his basement?
Nope.
A wine cellar. And this third. This bill here is, this is not a whining situation. I'm the last guy to ask for more government regulations on businesses. I don't like it, but sometimes things need to be done. But it's not getting paid when the payment is due is getting ridiculous. So I think this is a case where the government should get involved to help resolve this problem. The seed companies are not willing to regulate themselves, which they have proven over the years they are not. Then there needs to be a law that they will pay attention to. So I would like your support on HB 2050 with the changes that they've talked about. I'm tired of financing seed companies with no benefit to myself. When my wife goes to Safeway, she pays at the cash register. When my fertilizer and chemical bill comes, I pay it, or I get charged a finance charge and interest for a late payment. I could go on for a while with lots of examples. When my seed check is due, I'm very lucky if it shows up in 30 days. There are a few companies that do pay on time. However, usually the check arrives 35 to 60 days, and the seed company lasts all the way to the bank. Right now, I'm powerless. I invoice these companies. I call them, ask for the money. Many times, I have to drive to the seed company's office and pick up my check. I know a farmer's time is cheap, but this is beyond aggravating. I've heard all kinds of excuses why they won't pay me. I'm here to tell you that I have to use a bank operating loan, and I have to pay my bills on time. And I imagine you have to pay your bills on time also. Under current federal law, livestock have to be paid for in 48 hours. Grain has to be paid for in 24 hours. All we are asking is for 30 days. The ag economy is the worst it has been since the early 1980s. Farming is the only business that you buy supplies retail and sell your product wholesale. The bill is not going to make seed prices higher or make grass seed farming more profitable, but it would be one less headache for the grower and possibly reduce overhead costs to the bank. And I'll answer questions if you have any.
Members, have questions from Eric? Eric, do you think that the enforcement provisions in here in terms of ODA having the ability to assess the situation, and if no payment is made, in essence, rescind a seed dealer's license, is that adequate for you?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, the interest rate for 10 months is reasonable, and I think the revoking the license is reasonable.
Okay.
I think just the hint that it's there, I don't think we're going to have a problem, really. I think they'll probably just fall in line and do the right thing.
But there's still flexibility in this bill for you as a farmer to agree to, I mean, you can negotiate with the seed company on whatever terms of contract.
Right.
And they may say, look, you know, for this particular type of product, we're not going to pay you for 45 days. And you have the option to say yes or no to that.
Yeah.
In terms of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, good. Doug, welcome.
Yeah, I'm Douglas Fast. I'm a farmer in Polk County. I also am Polk County Farm Service Chairman in Polk County. I have a global contract that was actually a contract to pay either in December of 2000 or January of 2000, and then payment 30 days thereafter after shipment. Well, this particular seed grower has been dragging its feet, and I have yet to see more than 10% of my clover crop, over 500 acres of my clover crop. I've only gotten about 10% of my payment. And I'm tired of calling on a daily basis and not getting any response. And he needs to have some key put in this law so that a fellow like this just can't keep relying.
How many, that's a lot of clover.
That's over 200,000 pounds of clover, yes. And
how much of your farm does that represent?
That represents half of my farm.
Half of your farm?
Yeah.
So, sounds like you might have a significant cash flow issue here.
Yes, because I do have a real cash flow issue.
You think that
the way this bill is worded, that it gives you the teeth that you need to be able to collect on a timely manner?
Well, it will help, but it will also help put out the fellows like this that take advantage of a grower like me who I can't afford to be 30 days out and would like to see him on business.
Okay. Members, you have questions for Doug?
Chair.
Vice Chair Nelson. This is Eric Bowers and Doug Fast.
Fast.
Douglas, excuse me.
Mr. Fast and Mr. Bowers? I like what you do. This is interesting to me in that coming from other types of industry, we do not have a State Department doing the enforcement on our collection. I'm concerned that in this bill, there's not an ultimate commitment of a crime, ultimately in here you just can just flat not get paid and that's it, the way I read the bill. I mean, there is still no...
There's no guarantee.
No guarantees. I just don't see any real solution to what I think it is we were trying to get to.
Actually, Representative Nelson, we actually took care of that issue previously when we passed House Bill 2051. Which strengthened our lien laws.
Right, got the lien law, but still got to.
Step.
I want to, but I want everybody to eat. Have some water and, the ladies a new dress and gas, some money. So I don't know. I'm just wondering, how deep the clause should be. And does this really solve the problem? And if it does, and you're happy, I'll be happy. I won't worry. I'll be happy. But I really don't see that final, really, that point that we really wanted to get to. So.
Well, I would think, Representative, that it's probably about as far as we can go. The only other step that I think a farmer or any other businessman would have if they ship product under contract and are not paid is either to litigate or, in the case that we have, is strengthen the lien laws that we have. In Doug's case, he's 4 months out, in essence, being paid 3 to 4 months out. And in too much longer, he probably would be wise to go file a lien, especially for that amount of money, on this particular dealer under the new lien law, assuming that we get it passed quickly.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, maybe ask Mr. Fast. Could you have already sold your crop? Could you have already? Yes.
Well, not when it basically when you sign a contract.
No. I mean, fair is fair.
Yes.
Could you? Could you have? I have farmers who can't sell their fetch. Could you have sold your clover right now if you by Dane?
Basically, if I had a buyer, yes.
You could
yeah.
do it. Okay.
And actually, Representative, a provision in this contract would allow for him to be able to do that even though he was under a contract. Under the Federal Plant Protection Variety Act, if you're growing the variety of seed that is covered under that act, if the dealer doesn't, after a certain date, if the dealer doesn't take it within 30 days, currently the grower can give notice to that dealer that he's going to sell it under that brand name. And the dealer then has the option of coming in and purchasing the seed at that time or letting, in this case, Doug would be able to, he would be released from his contract this year by his dealer, and he would be able to sell it on the open market. That's what we're
That's
saying.
That's what I need to read.
Yeah, exactly. We're extending that protection in the federal government, in the PVP now, to all of these grass seed crops, which we currently don't have. So that would be a very helpful option.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Fast, Mr. Bowers, you could have 30 days under this Plant Act. I guess I need to get familiar with that. I don't know that one. But then you could have another 30 days to find another buyer, another 30 days to transport it, and another 30 days to get it delivered. And you're 4 months out, and it's Christmas, and
it's not.
And it's not. Okay. I need to get familiar with this. I just wanted you to get the, you know, really the teeth into a solution so that, I mean, we should knock out these numbers. It's just wrong.
Jeff, or Mr. Chairman, on that 30 days.
Is that perfectly all right, Derek?
The interest starts on the end of the 30 days, correct?
That's correct.
Interest day.
Right. Okay, thank you both very much. I do appreciate it. The chair's going to switch gears momentarily because we have Representative Patty Smith in the audience, and she has attended for a specific bill, and I'd like to have her come forward. We're going to recess the hearing on House Bill 2050 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3003. And then we, as soon as Representative Smith has concluded her testimony, we will go back to House Bill 2050. And, well, it's,
you're very important.
You're an important person.
Oh.
Not that anyone else in the audience is it now.
Well, let's hope you say that after you hear what I have to say.
Welcome, and for the record.
Thank you. I'm State Representative Patty Smith. I represent House 56. Can you hear me?
No.
No.
Just move it much more.
How's that?
That's
Can you
better.
Hear me now?
Yes.
State Representative Patty Smith, House District 56. It goes from Troutdale to the Dalles to Mount Hood. And I've given you my written testimony, so I'll make it brief because I know the hour is late. And I've also given you a map of the National Scenic Area because it's really important. This is House Bill 3003. I thank you for the opportunity to present my testimony, and I'm going to give you some reasons today for my opposition to House Bill 3003, particularly as a resident of District 56 and also as a pioneer granddaughter of the Columbia River Gorge. I do not have affected property by this, but I want to give you a brief history of the scenic highway, we call it in Corbett. It has had many names through the years. It's now known as Historic Columbia River Highway. I do not know why in the bill it's called State Highway 100. I've never heard that before, just for the record. But I know how firsthand it is overregulated. And it's probably, I would say, the most protected highway in the nation. The National Scenic Area is the only one of its kind in this United States, a first. And the historic highway starts right at Troutdale. As you can look on your map, it's kind of hard to see, but it travels around and meanders through the gorge. Sometimes it stops, like at Ainsworth Park is where it stops, and then it takes up again in Hood River. So it's kind of hard to tell from the map, but I think it was designated one of the American highways a couple years ago. So it has a lot of protection on it. It has over 60% public-owned state lands, federal lands. So what we're talking about here is a regulation on private property owners, and that's my objection to it, that it would overburden the private property owners who happen to own property along this highway, many who've owned it for generations. One who was going to be here today, Chris Winters, and his family own 8,600-foot frontage along the highway, just at the point where it leaves Troutdale and comes into, actually before Corbett, Springdale. And he actually owns land that, you know, it's long in nature, so it has a lot of frontage. The other part of his property is already affected not only by the scenic highway designation, but the Sandy River, what is a wild and scenic waterway, which has a quarter-mile buffer already in place. So he's totally restricted if he would try to do logging. He would first have to go to the Oregon Forestry Department under the forest practices, and then he would have to have that oversight by the committee that manages the scenic wild waterways. So there's a lot to do. You don't just go out and log along the scenic highway. And the best part is they never have. People just don't do that. People who live along that highway love that highway. People who live in the gorge love the gorge and live there for a reason. And are very upset at all the burdens placed on them. Sometimes very unfairly, never with compensation, but always over-regulated. So they would view this as one more regulation. The other problem is the U.S. Forest Service is in process of what we're calling an 8-0 buyout. And if you don't know what that is, that's Section 8-0 of the National Scenic Act.
and the Forest Service is offering, anybody who offers their property that's in the special management area through March 31st, which would be this weekend, the Forest Service will have 3 years to buy them out. Now, they don't necessarily have to buy them out, but can. So what this would do is put another restriction in that would cause the value of their property to go down, to make it as brief as I can. In that three-year period, if they offer their land for sale, the government will provide an assessor who will appraise their land. If we put a designation on that devalues that property, this is going to hurt them if and when they do affect a sale. Not saying they will, but it could happen because this would affect general management area. So there's a potential there for loss of value. There's no way of knowing who owns these private properties along the National Scenic Area in the gorge on the Scenic Highway 30. It has so many names, it's amazing. It travels through several counties, so we're talking about different zonings in different counties that could affect it. And because of the nature of the restriction of the 300-foot buffer, any logging would be more expensive to the property owner and create a hardship. Due to the fact that initially you harvest, you have to leave 50 trees per acre. You had to then replant and let them grow to 10 feet before you could harvest again. You've now got to harvest again. So you're doing more logging. It costs you more. The other thing is it's going to cost loss of harvest tax revenue to our school. And we're already impacted by no logging hardly at all. So it would affect our schools, special districts. And if this proposal is for the good of the public should buy this property and fairly compensate the already overregulated, often miszoned landowner. And that's about it. I would be glad to answer any questions. I know it's complicated, but at this point, to put in the National Scenic Highway or the Historic Highway would be a real burden on the property owners. Thank you.
Are there any questions of Representative Smith? Representative Smith, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this scenic highway designation would impact private landowners, is that right?
Absolutely, the ones that still live there.
Mm-hmm. And they own timber land, and this is specifically for timber.
Sometimes they just happen to own land along the highway.
So even if they don't have timber, it would be impacted anyway?
Well, I guess this is for forest practices, so it probably wouldn't be.
It would be a loss of value. So this is a taking without compensation?
Yes, it would be a taking.
Isn't this why we have Measure 7?
Representative Smith, I would say fairly yes. Why we did get Measure 7.
The voters passed, let me see if I get this straight. Voters passed Measure 7, clearly, I believe, because they were tired of taking a private land, but yet we have a bill here before us today that wants to take more private land. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, that is what you're hearing.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure of that.
Thank you. Are there any other questions of Representative Patty Smith?
Okay, if not, thank you very much, Representative Smith, and we'll recess at this time and reconvene, recess our hearing on House Bill 3003 and reconvene the public hearing on House Bill 2050. And I believe our next two up are Jim Kramer and Jim Carnes. Gentlemen, are you here? If you will, please, as you know, I'm sure already, state your name for the record when you speak, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Kramer. I'm representing the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'd just like to offer a little testimony on the bill, one that the department first understands the plight of the growers and is in support of this bill. The other thing I might like to comment on just for a minute is provided you with a fiscal impact on this bill as we see it evolving, the department would probably like to make a statement as to its probably an overestimation of the bill. of the fiscal impact.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I don't have a fiscal impact.
I don't think any of us have the fiscal.
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I did not receive a fiscal impact from the legislative fiscal office as of yet.
So what you're saying, Mr. Kramer, is that the original fiscal is probably, because of the proposed amendments, is not accurate.
That would be...
And any succeeding fiscal would be considerably lower.
Would be my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Jim Carr, it's good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, Mr.
Chair. And for the record, state your name.
Chairman Krupp, members of the committee, my name is Jim Carnes. I'm here today representing the Perennial Ryegrass Bargaining Association to ask your support of House Bill 2050. I have served this organization as executive director since February of 1995. I've been involved in Oregon agriculture, primarily the seed industry, for more than 51 years, 40 years as a seed dealer. I'm the founder and former owner of International Seeds, Inc., Policy, Oregon, and served as its CEO until June 1989. And I'm also proud of Policy, Mr. Chairman.
As I am.
My industry background includes production and marketing, domestic and international, also research in the grass and legume seed industry. Other seed industry activities, I'm past president of the Oregon Seed Trade Association and also the American Seed Trade Association. Industry representative on the Oregon Highland Bentgrass Commodity Commission and the U.S. representative on the Executive Committee of the Federation of International Seedsmen, Geneva, Switzerland. The Perennial Ryegrass Bargaining Association, better known as the PRBA, was organized in August 1994. Today, the membership is 215 farm unit members, representing 63,737 acres of perennial ryegrass that produces over 95 million pounds of turf-type perennial ryegrass seed. This production represents approximately 35 to 40% of the total Oregon perennial ryegrass seed production. The PRBA farm membership is located in Lane, Lynn, Benton, Polk, Gam Hill, Washington, Clackamas, Marion, and Umatilla counties. Since 1957, I have seen three major seed dealers go into bankruptcy. Then the latest, ABT, which has acquired four other major Oregon seed dealers, go into bankruptcy. This may seem a small number, but when 25 Oregon seed dealers control 90% of the Oregon seed industry, this is a high percentage. The PRBA feels it is time for legislation to be passed to encourage the Oregon seed dealers to become more financially responsible. House Bill 2050 is a start. Thank you, and if you have a number, and as a member of the committee, if you have a question, I'd be glad to respond to that question. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Jim. Members, do we have questions?
Mr. Chair?
Certainly. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kramer, does the department currently provide this kind of service for any other agricultural product?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, not that I'm aware of.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Not having seen your fiscal impact statement, does the department have on staff now people with collections expertise or capability?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nolan, we have on staff accountants, if you will. This, as we have evaluated this bill, it's our understanding that we would have to have on staff someone with the ability to audit for whether payment had been received. And we do have on staff a grain warehouse examiner who provides that oversight in the grain warehouse department, audits for the commodities of grain that's on hand and determines whether the company has enough in stock to meet the obligation. So I guess to answer your question, I feel that we do have the expertise in a grain warehouse examiner to audit the facility to determine for payments.
Oh, okay.
Certainly.
actually led right into another question I had about this bill. If you look at line 6 of page 2 of the dash 2 amendment, you have that?
I do.
The bill directs the department to determine a reason that a payment hasn't been made, but doesn't direct the department to determine whether the payment has been made. And yet you suggested that one of the things you would have to do is to determine if a payment has been made. Would it not make sense for us to include that as a preliminary step before we start hammering someone?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I would wholeheartedly agree with you that that would be a first step, and possibly the reason may not be important.
Right, but debt is owing. I'm not sure we care why they haven't cut the check in. Backing up a little follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. Representative, does section 2 on line 2 of that same second page, does that get at your question? Because it says, if a licensed wholesale dealer fails to pay a seed grower as pursuant, then the grower may notify the State Department of Ag. Would we presume that then the grower would, as they go through the notification process, they would have to prove that they haven't been paid? Does that?
I don't know if that's what we'd presume. I don't see it here.
Mr. Chair, I would see the function of the department that they would still have to verify the claim of the grower, and that would require a review of the company's records, trace backs on checks, and inventory audits. So as Representative Nolan was saying, I think that it would have to still be verified as line A or line 6 in that might be adjusted to make that happen.
I might, Mr. Chair, absent an amendment to do that, the department is directed, shall proceed to determine the reason for the lack of payment on what might be a spurious claim. Perhaps it doesn't happen in your industry, Mr. Chair, but sometimes vendors and purchasers get into disagreement about not only whether payment has been made, but whether full payment has been made and other considerations that might not be clear and might prompt, shall we say, an unverified claim. But the department, under this language, has no option but to pursue it.
Okay, Representative, we'll, as we have additional clarifications that need to be made to, we're going to have a dash three here, not only for your reason, but for some other reasons also. I suppose I should mention that to all of you, that we're not going to work the bill out today because we're going to need to modify our modifications. Representative Smith.
And she raises the question to me also, line 6, to determine the reason the payment has not been made. Why do we need to determine the reason? Is that important? Because if we have a reason, are you saying that's a way out?
I'm going to call forward Dave Nelson, as he was intimately involved in the drafting of these amendments.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think the logic behind that, or at least the thought, if there was logic or not, you can determine. The thought was that frequently a simple call by the Department of Agriculture saying, we understand that you haven't made a payment, do you have a reason that you can tell us that you haven't made a payment, would precipitate payment being made, and that would be the end of the issue. And so that was the desire of the drafters of the amendment. It wasn't to get into the depths of tell me psychologically why you haven't paid this guy or that guy or the next one, but it was simply to begin the process with a job owning
to, which we felt would frequently precipitate payment.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, well, Mr. Nelson's here.
Okay, she has a follow-up, then you're next, and you're next, and Representative Nolan.
So, and then the person on the other end of the phone says, well, you know, I was on vacation, da, 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 da. And then the Department of Ag person who's on the phone makes a determination that that's okay since payment wasn't made?
The intention was, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the intention of the language was not to say, no, that's okay, but the intention was for the department then to say, under the terms of this act, you have 30 days to come current with your payment.
So it's in there for a reminder call?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go back to my original statement that I started with a while ago. Gentlemen, I don't believe we got what we wanted, and I'm not even a grass seed grower. But I don't think we have any teeth in this. I mean, I don't want one of those traps that y'all approved, you know, out there for those moles and whatever else we can catch now. You know, on line one, or on page one, it says, section two, Mr. Chair, seed production contracts may require. Am I reading the right bill?
No. You are, and Representative Nelson, I should tell you that that is going to be amended.
Okay, well, this was the proposed amendment. So all I'm just saying, we got a lot of that in here. We got a maybe. You know, we may require this, and then, you know, if we got a good cigar, we'd rather smoke it and not require it today, mañana. I'm not being facetious, but I'm just saying I see a lot of that, and I'm just trying to get teeth in something. Additionally, it says, upon notification by a grower. So, now we already have a contract, as I understand. I'll pretend that Mr. Bowers is my grower. And I already have a contract with him. Well, I don't even have to call you, the Department of Agriculture, to tell you. I mean, the call is the money's in the house. I mean, that's his call. And if it didn't, I mean, the notification, I mean, there was a day the money was due and it wasn't. And this was what I asked originally, you know, what happens to this guy? I mean, all sorts of sad stories. You know, it had a wisdom tooth impacted and, you know, Tootie had him on vacation, and heaven forbid. And the next, okay, and that was the top of page two. The third one says, determine the reason that the payment has not been made. You know, and then we're saying over what period of time. You know, I just think there need to be some penalties, you know, that are doubled up that make us, other than putting this guy, you know, behind bars in, you know, what is that place? Where they don't get to watch TV, a real prison. You know, I mean, we don't, I'm afraid we're missing it. And I think we have this opportunity, and I think we need to clarify that because I don't see legal action. I work with, you know, 200 attorneys for the past 25 years of my life, and I know what teeth are. And I think we need some more of it. I think you're too nice, Dave. And and by dang, I think if Mr. Carnes can farm for 51 years, you know, I bet you know, you wouldn't argue with him. And let's get some.
Would you gentlemen like to respond?
Mr. Chair, if I might respond, I think that there is more bite to this bill than the Vice Chair alludes to. Section 2 on page 1, line 1, in your hand engrossed, if you will, changes the may to must, which was, I think, a necessity to make the bill work.
So this one, even though it has the same date, should come before this one?
Those are my handwritten notes.
So the handwritten comes
you, yes,
after
that's the one that, that's the one that we're working with, day. Yes, and that we would suggest that we would take back to Legislative Council to make those corrections in Legislative Council's words.
Okay.
The purpose of the bill is to as I think the chair described, to walk a relatively fine line between being too onerous on seed companies and encourage them to move production to Canada as opposed to remaining here in the Willamette Valley. But at the same time, put some progressively stronger bite to causing prompt payment or to it precipitating payment to seed growers.
So with my follow-up, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, you know, what happened is, you know, a few bucks up front for all the money I'm putting out. I'm serious.
No.
And then what in the heck happened to incremental payments? I mean, you know, I've been doing something during this period of time. I'm just wondering where those are, and I think you you deserve it, and we ought to get it.
Oh, Representative Nelson, one of the things that we did in agreeing and working this out with the seed trade industry and the dealers was to allow flexibility in the contract. So in other words, some dealers do put some flexible terms in their payments. Some dealers pay a third at the time of delivery, a third 30 days, a third 60 days. There's variations in contracts that work for different dealers. And we're still allowing that flexibility in here. In other words, a dealer can go to a farmer and say, you know, 30-day contract, full payment. A dealer can go to a farmer and say, third, third, and a third. And it's up to the farmer to determine, negotiate with that dealer what kind of a contract the farmer's willing to accept. So we wanted to have some flexibility. That's part of the give and take of this process. And keeping in mind, members, that these are just proposed amendments and proposed language. These will be amended even further. Jim, I think you wanted to say something also.
Yes, in response to Representative Nelson, Mr. Chairman. I haven't been a dealer for over 40 years. I've been a farmer for 50. I represent farmers at this time and have since February of 95. But the threat of realism of this dealer not having a seed dealer's license, that is in itself is this is the way the seed trade talks in the state of Oregon, in fact, the United States, of the international markets. If something happens at 4 o'clock, by 4:30, the other 25 seed dealers know all about it. And the threat of a seed dealer losing his license or being set to question is going to be a very serious thing, not only with this grower, but banks, other farmers that are dealing with this company. And he's basically going to be out of business because if this happens, it'll be like a run on the banks because he not only owes this one grower money, but he's going to owe several other growers, or he might owe 50 other growers as well. And just that threat, he'll be out of business if he doesn't compensate that grower for the money that's due it. And this is a first step. We're not saying anything can't be improved on, but this is the first step.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to close with my last final remark is that, you know, in most situations like this, we have some kind of security, you know, backing up these type of contracts. And we have none. I did the same thing that happened here, as I mentioned earlier, in potatoes in the 60s. So, you know, us dumb people got smart. But, you know, we should have required, you know, some kind of security because we put a lot, heck of a lot of money in that soil.
Thank you. Representative Doyle, you're next.
I had my question passed.
You did. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, or maybe since you drafted it. Is this intended to be a substitute or a complement to other remedies that a grower has to recover the debts owed to the grower?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I think it's a complement to the normal contracting processes. And as you probably know, and also you made a comment I'd like to respond to earlier that does this put the Department of Agriculture in the collection business? I think the answer there is emphatically no. It just simply puts the department in a position of saying to the seed dealer that part of your responsibility to hold a seed dealer's license is to be financially responsible. If you're not going to be financially responsible, then you don't hold a license. That's the end of their responsibility. they don't go out and pursue the seed dealer to collect on behalf of the seed grower. That's the seed grower's responsibility to do that. And if they're going to finally, the ultimate is to litigate the contract and all of the processes that ultimately goes through. What we try to do is to put this in place between the date of not payment and the litigation to try to put a bite on the seed dealers who were not paying growers in a timely fashion by putting their license to do business at risk.
Certainly.
And Mr. Nelson, I am a big fan of systems that get to a solution quickly and outside of court. And it sounds like this is attempting to do that. Is there an appeals process if a dealer believes that the claim was inappropriately asserted or that the department's determination that the claim had been paid was false?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, the answer to that is yes, and I think that appeal is in subsection 3, that the dealer is entitled to appeal a determination by the department that they may or may not be delinquent.
And the appeal is to, I'm sorry for
sure,
not knowing,
that's all right.
ORS 183.
Who do they appeal to? I presume they would appeal to the director of the department.
That's probably a wise course of action.
Actual hearing is probably.
Chuck, welcome for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. Chuck Craig, Deputy Director at ODA. The bill as currently written references the Administrative Procedures Act for the state of Oregon as the appeal process. So what that means is that a person who wanted to appeal would be granted a contested case hearing before an independent hearings officer. The director is the final authority in our agency who would make the final decision based on the findings of the hearings officer. But also, generally speaking, in cases like this, the department offers people an opportunity for an informal conference with the director prior to going this formal route, too, if it looks like there's a way to settle the issue or resolve it without it going through a formal case.
And I think this is my final comment, because I'm trying to end with something that is usable and enforceable and, in fact, accomplishes the objective of solving these things quickly rather than creating another procedure that just delays the payment to the farmer. On the first page, lines 21 and forward, a seed production or purchase contract must require payment within 30 days. If you're looking at amendments, I would suggest you look at that language so that you don't somehow create a situation where if it doesn't, it's not enforceable. And not being a legislative council drafter, seems to me that your definition under final payment date, where you say absent a schedule for payment, it is presumed that the payment is due within 30 days, may get at what you're trying to accomplish and not invalidate a contract that doesn't have a payment date.
Mr. Chair, we'll look at that. Discuss it with with legislative council and with Representative Doyle, who represents a number of seed growers.
Okay, anyone else have questions on the panel? Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Thank you. Chair would like to call the next three witnesses to come together, Brian Glaser, Gene Wilkerson, Oregon Farm Bureau, and Bob VanderZanden. If you would all please come forward. The chair would like to inform the audience, due to the lateness of the hour, we are not going to hear House Bill 3811 today. We will reschedule that for hearing on Tuesday. And we are also not going to hear Senate Bill 315 today.
And we are going to take some limited testimony after this on 3003, as we've had a very nice gentleman travel a long distance here to share his thoughts on that. We will also not work House Bill 3003 out of here tonight. Thank you. Please proceed.
Chairman Krupp, members of the committee, I'm Jean Underhill Wilkinson, and I'm an associate director with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I've been in front of you multiple times already this session, and we do really appreciate your work and assistance with passing the agricultural lien package. I know you've heard a lot about the seed industry this session and the plight of the farmers who produce that seed. We really support House Bill 2050. We think it's a good idea. It's a tool to put in our package of tools that we're building for these farmers. Because as you know, as you've heard, with discussing agricultural liens and with this issue, farmers are forced to accept an inequitable amount of risk in their part of the production, agricultural production and marketing process. And we need to level that playing field and provide them more tools. Agricultural lien laws are one of those tools. This type of program would be another one of those tools. I think it's necessary for this program, for both types of tools to be in place. I see this bill as encouraging dealers to take seed from farmers when they are in a position to pay for it and they're ready to pay for it. And the agricultural lien laws, of course, are more of a last resort. This type of program certainly wouldn't help a farmer with a company bankruptcy situation, as you know. And of course, agricultural lien laws force the farmer eventually to foreclose on the company's assets. So that's more of a last resort when nothing else can be done. But this is more of an encouragement for timely payment to the growers. So I think it's positive. Assisting the farmers, this may be able to be used as a model for other areas of agriculture through time. And I think it's going to take a combination of education, regulatory mechanisms like the laws that you've been passing out of this committee, the bills you've been passing out of this committee, and contractual mechanisms to reduce the risk and level the playing field amongst all the players in the agricultural industry, and to create creative pieces of legislation that is palatable for everyone. And I think this is fair, and this is a good idea. I hope you'll support it with us. I have here Brian Glaser and Bob VanderZanden. They can introduce themselves. They're farmers that have been very involved in the seed industry and were involved in ABC bankruptcy and are working with us to come up with some of these creative solutions.
Thank you. Bob, for the record,
evening.
Say your name.
My name is Bob VanderZanden. I and Brian have served on the board of the ABT Seed Growers Association for a little over a year and 2 months now. I've been deeply involved in that. I know you guys have heard a lot about it. I don't want to go into it other than more to say that it was destructive for a lot of people. We had to make settlements with folks because our lien laws weren't strong enough. We didn't have the opportunity to do a lot of things. Now we have a chance to start rebuilding our industry, and I see the lien law work that we did as the first step. You folks were very, very good with the kind of work you did there, and I think this is the next step. When I was on school boards, the people in the industry, the education industry, like to talk about progressive discipline. This is really a step towards progressive discipline, if you will, the lien law being the last resort, the prosecutor, the litigation of lien laws and so forth. This gives us an interim step, kind of like the progressive discipline kind of thing. We're cooperating with the rest of the people in the industry. We're working with the brokers and the dealers. The growers are working in a cooperative way with them. I think this is what good government's about, and we appreciate your efforts on our behalf. Thank you.
Thank you. Brian, for the record.
Chairman Krupp, members of the committee, I'm Brian Glaser, a farmer just south of Albany. I'm a fourth-generation farmer in the grass seed industry. I've dealt with many companies that have paid on a prompt schedule, and there's never been a worry. I've also had to deal with companies that it's just a pain to deal with. You've got to go beat on their desk. You've got to make phone calls constantly to try to get pay when pay is due. We work very diligently in trying to produce a crop that we can contract with the companies, and the companies can sell, and everyone can benefit from that through a piece of the profit. But I also need to be paid. I've got bills paid. The bill shows up. I've got so many days to pay it, or I've got an interest charge. No questions asked. And it's a steep one at that. And I want the seed companies to respect me the same as I've got to respect those suppliers that I deal with. And right now, the respect's not there. There's some companies that do. They pay promptly. I've dealt with one this last fall. You know, payment 30 days, I had a check in 28, and they hand-delivered it. You know, that's a big difference from some of the ones that you got to make phone calls three times a week, four times a week. I go out to their, you know, to their office, beat on their desk, and they say, well, we'll put the check in the mail this afternoon, and a week later I'm calling them up and going beating on the desk again. I've got to do my part to manage the farm the best I can. I don't have time to be chasing after these little games. You know, it's time to put some teeth in some legislation that we can get these guys back in line. The respect needs to flow both ways. And I think it's time the seed companies start respecting the growers and dealing with us as an equal partner. And I think this is a step in the right direction, and I really urge you to support this bill. One thing I'd like to throw out in addition to that, where you talk about the interest rates, I'd like to see it steeper. I go down to the auto parts store, I pick up parts for the tractor or truck, come home, if I don't pay my bill, it's 1.5% a month. 1% a month here for the seed companies isn't enough. Right now, prime is real favorable. It's higher than prime. We get in a condition where interest rates rise again. All we're doing is turning to the bank. They'll take our financing at 1% a month. It's cheaper than they're operating on. Somehow we need to tie it to that and put a little more teeth into it as a deterrent such that they don't even think about using us as alternative financing as some of the companies are doing now. My bank's leaning on me to keep everything in order financially, and I think the seed companies need to do the same and take some of this responsibility on amongst themselves. So I'd urge you in your support of House Bill 2050. Thank you.
All right, thank you all. Do we have questions? Yes. Representative Doyle and then Representative Nelson.
Bob, just a question for you. When you enter into contracts, is it your assumption that you're not going to get paid?
No, it's my assumption that they will pay.
Okay, and how... and I assume you had that same assumption with ABT when you went through that contract situation. How would this provision have helped you with the ABT issue?
Almost 2 months before ABT filed bankruptcy, they quit paying growers, and they were delinquent for that time. This would have brought pressure to bear much faster to ABT.
My apologies.
That's all right.
And I don't think I addressed you appropriately, so my apologies.
Oh, that's okay. What kind of pressure are you talking about?
If this had been in effect, ABT started, they put a moratorium on grower payments, like I say, almost 2 months before they filed bankruptcy. Before that, they were slow, very slow with payments. And if we could have 3 or 4 months before they filed bankruptcy brought pressure to bear on them, maybe they would have been able to find some amicable solution before bankruptcy, some way of, say, reducing the size of their business or selling off inventory. And, you know, it's hard to predict what might have happened. All I know is a real bad deal the way it turned out.
And would you see in a situation like this that if, for instance, the Department of Agriculture had to get involved, that would have been public record,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, word would have been out to all the growers that
exactly.
You know, at least some growers were having problems,
yeah.
and others could have been able to take action a little quicker than what they were able to.
Of that is, we during the bankruptcy, we found out being on the committee and dealing with attorneys that were intimately involved in the bankruptcy, we found out that ABT was on cash only. Businesses in June and July down in Arizona and California with a lot of their suppliers. Then, but here we were in the Willamette Valley not knowing that they were in a lot of trouble a long time before we ever found out about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of thing, you know, if they're delinquent with one grower, then pretty quick the Department of Ag knows about it, and it starts the process. It brings pressure to bear, people find out about it, maybe we don't have to go through another one of these terrible messes that we've had to go through.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions? Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. With Gene sitting here, and I don't know if the other two are lawyers too, but you know, I seem to want to put a bonding requirement for this wholesale dealer in here, get the state out of, you know, bill collecting. The only two times that I've ever seen that work is one, when they use the bounty hunters to go collect child support payments in Detroit, and they were achieving a 95%. Now, maybe we could try that with these wholesale guys. But, I mean, that's a true story. And then there was one other time that a school system wanted the state to go pick up their overdue library fines. You know, that'd scare any parent to death. But I'm just saying, I don't think our purpose is that we want the state to be our bill collector, but I think a bonding capacity, a requirement that can be drawn upon, knock off the nonsense, get your money, and, you know, be on your way and be happy, like Mr. Carnes told me to do, you know, don't worry, be happy. I think that needs to be in here. And I'd spoken to Chairman Krupp about this earlier, weeks ago, and I still, you know, I think I'm pretty strong on this, and I'd just like to throw that out.
Chairman King, Representative Nelson, I appreciate your comments. During our discussions during the interim, when many people sat around the table and tried to find ways of resolving the problems in the seed industry, and we'll continue to have those conversations, bonding was discussed to some degree. It turns out it seemed to be a pretty controversial issue because bonding is expensive, and it was questionable whether it would produce enough funds to really help people. And within the industry, I think bonding is a controversial issue that probably needs to be mulled over a little bit more. I would expect that both indemnity types of funds and bonding issues will be the subject of conversation as time goes on with regard to the feed industry and other agricultural commodities. But I just felt like we didn't get to a point during the interim on bonding to really, really have an agreement amongst the industry as to how to put that tool into a legislative bill this go around.
Any further questions? Hearing none, this concludes the public hearing on House Bill 2050. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3003. Will the clerk read the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3003 we heard on March 6th. To remind you, the issues discussed was the 91 comprehensive rewrite of the Oregon Forest Practices Act, scenic buffers, protection of visually sensitive corridors, historic Columbia Gorge scenic designation, special management area and general management area, State Route 242 logging operations, potential private property owner impact, regulatory takings, and basic conflicts in current law. We have before you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, -1 amendments. The -1 amendments exempt areas inside urban growth boundaries, areas lying outside an urban growth boundary, and included or referenced in an acknowledged comprehensive plan or land use regulation of a county that is not a farm or forest zone or a zone for residential uses. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you very much. We have Chris McNick and Mr. John Foster, who has driven more than 100 miles. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I will be brief, and I appreciate your fortitude this evening. It's been a very, very long hearing. With me, actually, is John Papineau. He's the state chair, state president of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and John Foster is to my far left from the Clackamas County chapter. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. At issue this afternoon is House Bill 3003, which does propose to add two additional highways to the list of highways designated as scenic for the purposes of the Forest Practices Act. The Oregon Small Woodlands Association opposes this effort. Prescriptive land management regimes under the Oregon Forest Practices Act are increased with the additional regulatory overlay of a designated scenic highway in several real, tangible ways. A 300-foot buffer is immediately delineated on properties along the highways. Within that 300-foot buffer, only the first 150 feet or the second 150 feet may be harvested The second 150 feet may be harvested only when trees in the reforested portion of the first harvest area reach a height of 10 feet, and slash and debris must be cleaned and reforestation conducted under an expedited schedule. I'd like to publicly commend the Department of Forestry, and particularly Ted Lorenzen and Greg Klein, for their efforts since the first hearing at helping us identify potentially affected private property owners. I do remain concerned, though, that we have not necessarily identified all potentially affected landowners. Yesterday, I had information about a parcel of land owned by an elderly woman which had not previously been identified on the district's map. I'm not sure that it was identified on the district's map or department's map. OSWA is supportive, however, of the Dash 1 amendment and would support the passage of House Bill 3003 in the event that the original language is deleted and the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. However, simply adopting the Dash 1 language into the existing bill while assisting the department and landowners within UGBs and rural residential areas would not prevent a regulatory taking on other landowners who own property along highways not previously designated as scenic, and OSWA would oppose that. Attached to my testimony is a hand-engrossed version of language that the Small Woodland Owners Association would be happy to support, and I appreciate, again, your tenacity this evening.
Thank you.
Sure.
I think we had a question, Representative Smith.
Regarding your testimony, an elderly woman which had not been previously identified, what's that to do with?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department worked hard at identifying affected parcels of land that this legislation would affect. And I worked with one of our members who is from Lane County who came up with a land planner. And to make a long story short, I've made several phone calls and identified four pieces of land which I've been able to extract from this process through a variety of means. But basically, there remained one woman who's 84 years old. She has 3/4 of a mile of property that runs along the McKenzie Highway. And she would clearly be affected if this bill was passed.
Is she aware of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I talked with her on the phone 2 days ago. She was not aware of this legislation. She wasn't able to come here. She's 84. It's difficult to get around. I asked if she would be interested in writing a letter. And frankly, this stuff is just confusing to people.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, she is very disturbed about clear cuts. She loves her trees. She's managing her trees in that fashion. And she intends to sell her property to someone who shares those values. But on the other hand, she was very clear to me about her feeling of government regulation and over-regulation and not being compensated for that regulation. And she shared with me that she is going to have to make a decision in the near term about going into some sort of assisted care facility and that she is going to sell her property. And by our view, that represents a lot of the typical landowner community in the Small Woodlands Association. The older people, they've invested their savings over a lifetime in property rather than in stocks, rather than in maybe rental units. They've invested in forest land property. And when we start applying these regulations, that clearly takes away some of that value.
With the property owners that you have talked to, have they indicated to you since this change was coming that they might accelerate some of their harvest practices along their designated areas?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, no property owner that I've talked to has indicated that, but I do know. In fact, I was speaking at the Yamhill County OSWA chapter last night, and I had a forest practices forester, a young guy. In fact, he's going to be receiving an award by the state forester at the next coming meeting. He said, look, I know that people make changes in their management regime based on regulation. He said, I know. I've done that. I've harvested in streams. I've harvested nearby in ways that they wouldn't otherwise have considered. But because they won't have that option in the future, they feel that they need to do those things now rather than lose it.
So as I understand, the Small Woodlands Association would be happy if the bill, if we took out Columbia River Scenic Highway and the McKenzie Highway?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nick, go ahead.
Chair King, members of the committee. My name's John Foster, and I live near Estacada, Oregon. I'm a small woodland owner. I'm here today to testify in opposition to amending the Oregon Forest Practices Act to include the Columbia River Highway. In 1995, I was the chair of the Oswa Legislative Committee. At that time, the Columbia River Highway was proposed to be included under the Forest Practices Act as it is today under House Bill 3003. After hearing testimony, the Senate amended the bill to not include the highway. In the House, a motion was made to add the highway back in the bill, and again, after hearing testimony, it was voted down in committee 6-1. Many, if not all, the same points are just as applicable today as they were 6 years ago. If the intent of the bill is to provide a scenic buffer for the pleasure of a significant number of the traveling public, this bill does not do that. While some parts of the highway include parts of the original Highway 30, other parts of the original highway were removed when I-5 was built, or I-84 was built. Still, in other parts, it is not maintained and was abandoned, even though it still shows on the map. Some tunnels may be blocking presently part of the highway. A section in the east end is just a hiking trail, and they still call it the highway. In short, Highway 30 is not a high-traffic highway, nor can it handle heavy traffic without major reconstruction. I further believe that any major reconstruction will not be done because of the fact that Highway I-84 closely parallels the remaining sections of this highway between Troutdale and the Dalles. The highway can handle less traffic than most county roads. I have had conversations with a small woodland representative on the original committee that decided on which highways originally to be recommended to be included as scenic under the Forest Practices Act. This section of Highway 30 was left off on purpose because it is not a major highway. He commented to us several times that the list of highways was done through a series of compromises and that the committee agreed at that time that they would not come back in the future to continue to request that additional highways be added. The bottom line is that many times these buffer strip setbacks cause many landowners severe problems with layout and harvesting when they need to raise money by selling some of their trees. I would suggest today, the same as I testified in 1995, that it is important to leave these buffers, that if it is important to leave these buffer strips on secondary highways for, quote, the good of the public, then the public should consider buying these buffer strips through condemnation and quit asking the small woodland owner to shoulder the whole burden of these arbitrary rules. I believe the federal government still appropriates monies to acquire properties. In fact, Representative Smith testified to that earlier within the Columbia Gorge scenic area between Troutdale and the Dalles. In closing, I would like to thank the members of this committee for giving me the opportunity to testify on the bill, and I'd be glad to answer any questions if there is any.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? I'd just like to point out that as a sponsor of the bill, I was not aware of that history. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, please.
Moral support.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to leave in a minute, but I'd like to make a statement regarding the bill. I had the bill in my possession for, I believe, about 2 to 3 weeks. And after looking into it, having some conversations with several people, I declined to sponsor that bill. And one of the reasons was it flied right in the face of Major 7. The other thing, I was not able at that time, Department of Forestry or no one else, was able to furnish any information as to the number of landowners, the age of the timber, the value of the timber, or anything that would indicate that we would have any idea of how we were affecting private property rights issue. And after having seen what had taken place with Major 7, I felt that this flew right in the face of it. At first, it appeared that it was only going to be one or two property owners. And my first question was, if that was all we were dealing with, it's not good legislative policy to write bills for one or two property owners that are going to impact them. I would not support this bill as it's written now. I've made that known publicly. Perhaps if we did the dash, I guess it's dash two, that's exactly it. Is it dash one?
Dash one.
Dash one. I might be looking at that, but I really don't believe that this is the type of thing we should be doing. And one of the questions I asked is, well, do we know the age of these people that are affected? Is it somebody's retirement? Is it going to be some child's college education that we're taking that mom and dad or grandpa and grandpa are planning for? We don't think about those things. And when I was on the Board of Forestry, one of the things I told Jim Brown about new forest regulations, and you can ask him, that I just was not going to go there for societal values unless society was going to foot the bill. I think we need to be looking at that. That's how we got Measure 7. And I just don't think it's the right thing to do. If these societal values are so important, and we want forest landowners or people from agriculture to foot the bill, and let's say it's 10 or 15%, then let's ask everybody who's on PERS to pay 10 or 15% of their bank account for retirement, because they, as landowners, or those forest landowners, or ag people, store their retirement in a different fashion than what does myself as a public employee. I have a PERS check coming every month. I will probably not want to give up part of it for salmon habitat or scenic views or a whole string and host of things that we do. But we seem to come forward as private landowners because of a stewardship ethic in most instances and step up to the plate for environmental protection. We've demonstrated that. Oslo has, tree farm has. Most of those people go beyond what the Forest Practices Act say to protect environmental values. I think we need to be thinking about what we're doing. Thank you.
Let's see. We have Mr. Jim Threakill. I don't know if he's traveled 100 miles, but I'm probably pretty close to that. Ready to make one now?
Mr. Chair and remaining members of the committee, my name is Jim Threakill, and I live in Vida, Oregon. It's on the McKenzie River, and I'm here on behalf of the McKenzie Watershed Council. I'm coordinator of the Watershed Council. The council would like to voice its support for this bill, in particular the clause in there about including Highway 242, the old McKenzie Highway, under the Forest Practices Act. I think most of you may be familiar with the old McKenzie Highway. It starts in McKenzie Bridge and heads over the crest of the Cascades through the lava fields and Dierite Observatory, and lots of numerous access to trails to the Three Sisters and Mount Jefferson wilderness areas, and then it drops on over to the east side into Sisters. The Watershed Council was established in 1993 with the purpose of helping to address management issues within the McKenzie River watershed. And it provides a framework for coordination and cooperation among the diverse interests that are in the watershed, and all have a vested interest in the watershed. This is comprised of lots of residents, as well as federal, state, and local government agencies. Maintenance of the aesthetic quality of the McKenzie Viewshed was recognized in the Council's Human Habitat and Recreation Action Plan that was adopted in 1997. Language from this action plan states, and I quote, encourage logging practices to consider aesthetics and have less visible impacts, end quote. In addition, that theme has been repeatedly expressed in polls taken within the McKenzie River community. For example, McKenzie River Corridor Strategic Planning Survey conducted in 1995 and a similar poll conducted by Lane County Planning in 1999 showed the majority of respondents strongly supported maintaining the scenic quality of the watershed. The Watershed Council believes that this bill will encourage logging practices to consider the aesthetics and have less visible impact along the old McKenzie Highway, which also meets community interests. The designation of 242 would also provide much needed continuity of management throughout the heavily traveled route. As part of the federally designated San Ann Scenic Byway, this stretch of highway draws visitors from all over the world, and managing the area in its entirety for that intent will benefit the continued use. Tourism is a large and important factor in the upper McKenzie River area. And in this day of high levels of recreational driving, these areas are precious to the economy. The inclusion of 242 as a designated scenic area under the Forest Practices Act corrects an oversight that the Council believes is there and meets the needs of the communities of the McKenzie watershed. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yep.
Just real quick, Representative Doyle.
Thank you. Are you speaking on behalf of the Watershed Council or on your own?
On behalf of the Watershed Council. This was a statement drafted by the council.
Thank you.
Representative Doyle.
Representative Smith.
Since the McKenzie Watershed Council supports this, and since we have passed Measure 5, is the watershed prepared to compensate, Measure 7? We're living under an era of Measure 7 currently. And you support this, is the Watershed Council prepared to compensate these landowners for their loss?
Representative Smith, Chairman King, the Watershed Council exemplified here today in terms of the conversation about the pros and cons of Measure 7. And the Watershed Council believes that Measure 7 would be intact, and so the appropriate procedures would be in place to provide compensation.
You haven't answered my question. Is the Watershed Council prepared to compensate landowners for this loss?
No, the Watershed Council is not.
I see. So it's okay for somebody else to pay for something you want. Is that right?
It's okay when the endorsement is coming from residents of the watershed. One of the residents is affected by this particular bill.
Has he already logged his land?
No, he hasn't.
You mentioned tourism and recreational driving. Maybe we could set up a toll for the drivers to go through, and if they want to look at the trees, they can pay the landowners along the way. Would that be reasonable?
I guess hypothetically, Representative Smith, that would be reasonable,
and
yes.
How many people do you think would participate in that?
I have no idea how many people would participate in that.
I think it's probably as reasonable as you paying for this or the landowners is paying for this. It's all ludicrous. And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Mr. Threadkill, do you believe that if 3003 would pass, that people would have a reduction in their property values on McKenzie?
Chairman King, not being qualified in that area, I can't give you an expert of answer, but my gut feeling is no, that the property values would not be reduced.
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you very much for coming. We have one more witness, Ted Lorenzen with the Department of Forestry, and if there's someone else that would like to speak, they would be welcome to come forward as well. You'll be welcome, but I didn't see you on here. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Excuse me. You are there. You are welcome. Come on up. Can you walk us in here, please? And also, Ted Lorenzen is coming forward as well. Thank you. Go ahead, Jean.
Chairman King, members of the committee, I'm Jean Wilkinson with the Oregon... Pardon?
My apologies.
Oh, no problem. I'm Jean Wilkinson with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I do want to say that the timber industry has done amazing things through the years in providing the public with recreational opportunities, well-managed forests, for folks to enjoy, and for scenic opportunities. So the proponents and sponsors of this bill, I think, have some decent intentions. I think what they're after is a public good, and there's nothing wrong with that, and I think that's positive. On the other hand, there is a gentleman that has contacted me along the Historic Columbia Highway named Chris Winters, the same gentleman that has been in contact with Patty Smith. He is an active Multnomah County Farm Bureau member and small landowner along that highway. He's not happy with this bill. He's, as Patty had pointed out, he's dealing with overlapping regulations. I think that as far as supplying a public good, he feels that he has given enough. With the regulations that he's dealt with and to the extent it's depreciated his property. So an additional regulation that would put an additional restriction on his property, he's not interested in. And because he has a problem, the Oregon Farm Bureau has a problem. So I am worried about the impacts of the landowners along these scenic highways, but I'm perfectly willing to listen and participate in any amendments that are proposed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wilkinson. Also, Ted, you know, because of the hour, it looks like I also see maps and a pretty elaborate display. I think it might be, you know, if it'd be all right with you to ask, we maybe, you know, hold off on your testimony and request Chairman Krupp to be able to, you know, hold your testimony for next opportunity.
Great. Appreciate it. Thank you.
And I see Mr. Wilkinson. Thank you very much, Ted. Ray Wilkinson, please. You'd be welcome to come back if you wanted to hold for next time as well. It's your
right. I'd like to do that, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkinson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. We're the sponsors of this bill. I'd just like to say for the record right now, and then I'd like to come back also, that based on conversation we've had with Representative Patty Smith, we would not oppose an amendment to remove the Columbia River Highway from this bill, but we would strongly oppose an amendment to remove the McKenzie Highway from the bill. And I've testified as to the reasons before, and I'd be glad to do it again. The hour is late, but that would cause us to withdraw our support for this bill, which I think would be unfortunate because the Dash 1 amendments would provide regulatory relief to a lot of people. If they're approved, then we can have a bill that the governor would sign. So just wanted to get that in this evening. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for your patience for staying the distance and the rest of the people with your group. Thank you. This closes testimony on House Bill 3003, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.